STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi, this is Melinda the Enforcer with Stand to Reason, and this is the STR Ask podcast, hashtag STR Ask. And it's not Greg this week, it's Jay Warner Wallace.
Glad to be back with you again to try this out. It was good last time. We can do it
again.
Try
it out. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. There's another trying out.
Good.
This is your milieu.
Well, we'll see. Some of these questions. We'll
so
see.
Funny. Jim.
Well, you
I
know
mean,
what,
he's fabulous at all this, but Jim always is like...
Right. There's always this sense that, you know, you're going to say the one thing or the five things that expose you for the knucklehead you really are. Right?
Well, it's not my interest to expose that.
Well, no, I know, but I'm always afraid that I'm just going to stumble into that without even trying, right? So that's the problem.
That's true for all of us. There's always, for all of us, there's something we're knuckleheads on.
That's right.
So
that's right.
But I like that term, that's like an old-fashioned term, knuckleheads.
Knuckleheads, yes. It's a clean term, too. You can say it, and you can interpret it any way you want to interpret it.
And it's not necessarily an insult. Sometimes it's just,
right.
You know,
because we're
it's
all
a loving description.
That's right.
I remember when I was a teacher, my teaching partner, we taught 5th and 6th grade, and you know boys at that age.
Oh, yeah. They are knuckleheads.
Exactly. That's what my teaching partner would, because they're just knuckleheads.
Yeah. I don't even know what the root of that word is, but I know I had a partner who got saved after he became a police officer, before I met him, and he had exchanged every foul word that he had learned as a cop growing up, right, in the system, for an exchange word. And that he used knucklehead more than any other person I ever met. So I thought, I just learned it from him. That's why I use it too.
Yeah.
Right? Because it basically takes all the profanity out of your life. Just you have one word you can use, knucklehead. You're
just
good
your
to go.
Go-to word.
That's your go-to word, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, we're not going to expose your knuckleheadness here on this program.
Hope not.
And hopefully not mine. So it's hashtag STR Ask. That's the name of the show, and that's how you ask your questions. Go to Twitter. That's where we gather them and use hashtag STR Ask, and that's how we find them.
Awesome.
So let's get going. The first question comes from Justin T. Cook. What are some lay-level resources for investigating the reliability of the Old Testament?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot because, you know, the book was about investigating the reliability. My book was about the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do a lot with the New Testament that you can't do with the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you have to have is a sense of reasonable limits to your expectations. Because, you know, you can – if you thought you know when, John's Gospel is written within a certain time range, and then you can ask, well, who did John give this to? And you can trace the chain of custody, and you can trace the Gospel of John down through history – and see what people are actually saying about it. Well, Moses, if you say Moses wrote the first five books of the Old Testament, well, exactly what is the time range? How tight is it? And who did he give it to next? And then who did that person give it to?
Mm-hmm.
You just can't do it. You can't do it the same way.
So like the chain of custody, you're talking about chain,
right,
of custody,
chain of
which
custody
is really easy to follow with the New Testament,
yes,
but
you can't
do
that
with
the Old Testament.
The old.
Yeah,
okay.
And that's to be expected. With the more ancient a document becomes, the less likely you're going to be able to follow a chain of custody tightly. And that's the problem with the Old Testament, I think, one of the problems with it. So there are a couple of resources they've had on my shelf. They're not cheap resources, though, but they are lay-level resources. So I just want to throw a couple of them out there for people. One is just called On the Reliability of the Old Testament. It's about a $30 book in hardcover, and you can usually get it used, you know, on some of these different Amazon and other places. You can get it used as cheaper, you know, but even then it's about a $20 book. But it's worth getting because it's a great overview book. It's by K.A. Kitchen. And what's good about it is that it's got great references. You know, so if you thought, well, I want to chase this one down a little more, the bibliography will help you do that. And then, of course, then you end up with this huge collection of books. But I think a good gateway book is this thing, a book called On the Reliability of the Old Testament. The other one I like is a book that really focuses on biblical archaeology as a way to – now, there's limits to this, okay? And I always say this, too, that archaeology can just do so much for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a case – from archaeology for 19th century England, but that does not mean the story of Peter Pan is true. So there's limits. You know, historical fiction can also be corroborated by archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have some value. And this is called Biblical Archaeology, An Introduction with Recent Discoveries That Support the Reliability of the Bible by David Graves. These are the two volumes that I own that I think are good. Now, One last thing on this. If we were just asking, why is it as Christians we trust the Old Testament when we cannot test it in maybe the same amount of rigor that we use to test the New Testament? Well, here's why I think we can do this. We can use a great deal of rigor, I think, in testing the New Testament. And then we end up trusting what it says. Mm-hmm. And the chief character of the New Testament is this guy named Jesus of Nazareth, who vouches for the Old Testament repeatedly mm-hmm. throughout the New Testament. So if you can apply this rigor to the New Testament and you trust it, well, then you get the Old Testament thrown in because mm-hmm. Jesus is going to affirm the Old Testament in the New. So I think there's a sense in which we can have some confidence in this once we are already in as Christians, right? But I can understand why somebody would want to test it as an I did. And but I also had a sense of reasonable limits in what the evidence could do given the antiquity of the claims.
Now, one of the things, the manuscript evidence helps us with the reliability mm-hmm. of the Old Testament, doesn't it?
Yes.
And the Septuagint, because even though there aren't obviously nearly as many manuscripts as there are of mm-hmm. the New Testament pieces and all that, what there is, we can see
yep.
how carefully they were copied and passed on, right? And
right.
And then the Dead Sea Scrolls also.
It really
the
helped, yeah.
Scroll of Isaiah helped that.
Yeah, that was huge because we have a chapter in Isaiah that we have a copy in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we can see what transmission looks like over a course of 500 years. And when you think about that, just think about 500 years. Just think about 100 years.
And yeah. it had to be copied because
yeah.
papyrus decayed
That's
and fell
right.
apart.
And people always ask that question. My students always ask that question. Why don't we have an original? Well, think about what we're writing this on. This is not and think about the way this how often this was read. You can understand why we don't have an original. I mean, what would you encase if you were writing an original in the first century? What exactly would you encase it in? Unless you just wanted no one to ever touch it, right? And I think there's a sense you have in the New Testament that the people who were writing this stuff down did not think they were going to get out alive. They thought that Jesus was coming now.
Mm-hmm.
There was no sense that we have to write a document that we can preserve for 2,000 years. That wasn't the goal. The goal was we think he's coming back soon. So all we need to do is just get the word out soon.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have as a nature of documents that seem to me to be very, very temporary
mm-hmm.
because there was a sense that they wouldn't need them for 2,000 years. They knew in advance. They could have taken that original, put it in some kind of container, and just set it aside and only used copies. But there was a sense of urgency, I think, in the first century that really caused the demise of those documents.
Well, and also Christianity very quickly became a worldwide enterprise, and so you had you had the letters being sent to a church, and then that church copying to send them on to other churches.
That's right.
So they were going far and wide, where
yeah.
you didn't have that kind of geographical spread for the Old Testament.
Yeah, that's true, and I think that part of the problem too is that think about the number of years that pass. In the Old Testament and trying to track the handlers of the documents.
Mm-hmm.
We have a great capacity to do that in the first century because this became a matter of contention. People were accusing. I mean, when Irenaeus is making a defense of the New Testament, he's able to point to the handlers of the documents as part of his defense. And I really suspect that if he wasn't getting that kind of pushback, he might not have taken the time to collect and write about that. So it was in the context of adversity, right, in the Roman Empire, that we actually have good documents showing the transmission of the New Testament. So I think we just have an unusual set of circumstances that didn't exist for the Old Testament, and that's why I tell people you could not write a book like Cold Case Christianity using those tools with the Old Testament because mm-hmm. you just don't have that kind of manuscript evidence.
Mm-hmm. You brought up archaeological evidence, and like you said, it's limited. It doesn't mm-hmm. prove the truthfulness of a lot of things. But there have been, you know, pretty consistently over the years, things that have been referred to or situate contexts that are described in the Old Testament that historians have doubted, and then something in archaeology pops up that actually confirms that bit of truth.
Yes, if you were even just to look at the number of skeptics about archaeology, because think about it, there are several things, especially in Luke's writings, both in the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts, that really the only place you heard about these until the very early 20th century or the very late 19th century was in the Book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd mentioned things that nobody else was talking about, or there was no, at the time, archaeological verification for this. And so the skeptics who came out against the Book of Acts end up eating their words in the next 100 years as all of this archaeology then is, and I list some of this stuff in Cold Case Christianity, but that's pretty well documented, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, remember, this is a discipline of fractions, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that you're going to be able to substantiate everything in the New Testament from archaeology is just a fool's dream.
No.
But here's what I do say. If you looked, for example, at the Book of Mormon and the claims that are made in the Book of Mormon, and you asked, is there any archaeological support? Now, you might say, well, I can only support archaeologically 15, 20, 30, 40% of the New Testament. What do I do with the rest of it? Well, you can't support a percentage of the Book of Mormon's claims from archaeology. You can't do anything with it. That, to me, was very interesting. Mm-hmm. I would expect there to be something, not a lot, but something, given the antiquity of the events. But to have nothing, not a single city, not a single name from the Book of Mormon found anywhere on the continent, not a single artifact or relic or weapon or coin, not be able to draw maps. If you've seen the maps at BYU, when you go to BYU and look for Book of Mormon maps, take a look at them. You'll see the problem immediately. There is no archaeological support for anything in the Book of Mormon. That's the kind of thing that would give me concern.
The literacy of the Hebrews in Old Testament times, I know, is something that scholars have doubted, that they wouldn't have been, they were an illiterate people, so they wouldn't have handled these documents, they wouldn't have passed on these documents. And it's even something Bart Ehrman talks about, even with the New Testament. But there was just some kind of, there was an archaeological discovery just in the last several weeks. Did you see that?
Yeah.
I don't recall the details right now, but it shows that the ancient Hebrews were illiterate.
That's right. And what you see basically is that when we do find archaeologically, it always ends up being in favor of the claims of the Old and New Testament. That's always fascinating to me.
Yeah.
So it's not as though we have this collection of archaeological artifacts, half of which support the claims of the New and Old Testament, and half of which are really contradictory and disprove what that doesn't have. That's not the claim.
It's all in
it's
the
all,
of
yes.
Support.
And I wanted to read to you something I wrote, and I thought it was fascinating when I read it, from Dr. Edwin Yamauchi, who's at Miami University, who talks about why we shouldn't expect to find much in archaeology. He says this is a matter of fractions. He says only a fraction of the world's archaeological evidence still survives in the ground. In addition, only a fraction of the possible archaeological sites have been discovered. Of these, only a fraction have been excavated, and of those are only partially. And to make matters more difficult, only a fraction of those partial excavations have been thoroughly examined and published. And finally, only a fraction of what has been examined and published has anything to do with the claims of the Bible. So, I mean, this is really we shouldn't expect too much. And so when someone says, well, you can't make – what percentage should I expect? Very small. Mm-hmm. But again, this is very much the case. Imagine this. If you were accused of doing a bank robbery and I saw you do it and I saw you lean over the counter and point the gun at the victim, a piece of corroborating evidence would simply be your palm print on the counter showing that you were there. Mm-hmm. That would be brought into trial and offered as corroborating evidence of my eyewitness claim about you doing the bank robbery. But your palm print would say nothing about whether you had a gun, what you were wearing, what you said to the victim. It's a very small thing it corroborates.
Right.
It just corroborates that you were leaning on the counter. This is the nature of all corroborative evidence in criminal trials. I call this touch point corroboration. Mm-hmm. You don't have a videotape. You very seldom have a videotape. Instead, you have this little piece that's part of the larger puzzle. That's what archaeology is to the New Testament. It's a little piece. It won't tell you everything, but it starts to make the case for you.
Next question. Mm-hmm. I don't understand loving God. How can one love someone who is next to non-existent and that you can't actually talk to?
So it sounds like this question is coming from somebody who, as I was for 35 years, somebody didn't believe that God exists. So mm-hmm. Let's just take it from that perspective for a second. Let's just say that even as an atheist, I knew that I had a relationship both with grandparents I barely knew because they died when I was young, and I still loved them, and I felt like I had a relationship with them even though they were no longer with me. Not only that, when they were alive, they would tell me about my great-grandparents, and I fell in love with the men and women who were in my family that I never met. And I felt like I was part of that family relationship with those people who I never met. So even before becoming a Christian, I understood something of what it meant to have a relationship with somebody who I'd never met. And I could talk about them and be grateful that this attribute that I had in my life was descended down to me from that guy because he was just like me, whatever. So I think even as a non-believer, I know what it is to have a relationship. But now this is different. What if there was some – in the end – my as a Christian, I not only have a relationship with God who I may not be able to see, but I've started to see his work in my life. And I think what happens is that when I was a non-Christian, I was so good at denying God's existence that I would always interpret anything as chance and fortune and good fortune, you know, or bad fortune. And I never saw it in terms of God's working in my life. And the more I had a relationship with God, I'd see things and go, wow, in the past I've interpreted that thing that just happened as if there was no God. But now I'm seeing it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's fair if I've got good reason to believe that God exists. Mm-hmm. Now that I have that reason, I think I have the freedom now to interpret the things that happen in my life as God's interaction with me. So I'm no longer in love with this God who doesn't have any interaction with me. I see his work all the time. I ignored it for so many years because I denied God's existence. But now that I have good reason to believe he exists, I can see his work in my life. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that as Christians we do this. We don't have a relationship with the God we don't that's non-existent. I could see, though, why as a non-believer, the question is, have you really examined whether or not your worldview as a naturalist is true? Because if you're right and there's no God, then I get it. But if you're wrong about that, then the things you thought were good fortune or bad fortune or just chance really may be something entirely different, and you can start to see God's movement in your life. I think in the end, we either look back at our whole life and go, wow, what a great stroke of luck that I became a cop at that year, and then this happened to me, and that led to that. What a great set of dominoes happened to fall in the right way for me. Or we look at it and go, wow, this seems like it's part of an overarching plan. Now, why do we see it one way instead of the other? Because I think I've got good evidence to support the fact that there is a God who exists, who's interactive in his creation, and now I have the freedom because of that to interpret these actions as his work rather than chance.
Okay, we're just got a couple minutes, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes.
Okay.
This may sound kind of unfair, but I think you can do it because you know this. So can you give us, you don't have to expound on them, but can you give us in 2 minutes a reason to trust the Bible?
Okay, real quickly, this for me is all about eyewitness testimony. If we're going to trust the Bible, it's because we trust it as reliable, direct evidence. Direct evidence is simply eyewitness testimony. Everything else is indirect or circumstantial evidence. So for me, it was simply, do I trust what the Gospels say about Jesus? And that is always built on the four attributes of reliable eyewitness testimony. Was the person really there to see what he said he saw? Two, can he be corroborated in some way, even with touch point corroboration? Three, has he been honest and accurate over time, or has he been changing a story? And four, does he possess a bias? Those are the four attributes of reliable eyewitness testimony. So I simply looked at those four things with the gospel writers and asked myself, are they written early enough to have been written by people who were really there to see what they said they saw? Unfortunately, as even Bart Ehrman would say, the four gospels we have are the earliest accounts written in the region. Really hard to lie if you're going to write early in the region. Two, had they been corroborated in some way? Well, gosh, there's a litany of ways to corroborate both internal and external, from archaeology to the words, kinds of words that are being used, to the accuracy of government systems, of all kinds of other things you see in Scripture. That's another talk, but I thought that was reliable. And three, have they changed over time? Chain of custody. I can actually test that. That I knew for sure. There's no simpler version of Jesus that morphs into something more supernatural. And finally, do they possess a bias? Remember, only three kinds of bias that cause anyone to lie or to commit a crime or to commit murder. It's financial greed, sexual lust, pursuit of power. If these guys don't have financial greed, sexual lust, or pursuit of power, why would they lie? And so when I saw those things weren't there, worked against them in all the three areas, I thought, okay, so those four things exist in the gospel authors, and so I trusted them as reliable. Now, of course, the question is, what do you do with Jesus?
Right.
So that's, to me, I think it's important to test. And by the way, I became a Christian the same day I became a not Mormon, because I was looking at both of these systems simultaneously, and the Book of Mormon does not measure this way. There you go.
That's great. So just 4 points.
Four
can
points,
remember.
Yes.
Great. Good. Well, you weren't a knucklehead, Jim.
Okay, thank you. You made it through another session. That's good.
No, yeah, we made it through another one.
That's good.
Thanks very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it. So that's STR Ask for this time, folks. Send us your questions on Twitter, hashtag STR Ask. We do post 2 new episodes every single week on Mondays and Thursdays. So we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.